So Jeff told you why we do, or what we do. We exist to help people live like Christ in the world. That's what we do. But the question I want to talk about today is why? Why do we do that? Why we spend so much time talking to you up here, encouraging you, giving you opportunities, inspiring you, doing all the things we do to help you live like Christ in your world? And if you've been with us for a while, you're probably going, okay, I kind of know what's going on, but I'm betting that every once in a while, family members or friends ask you, like, why does Friends Church do what they do? Why don't they just do what every other church does? Because that's normal, isn't it? So today I want to get to that question of why do we do what we do? How many of you have been to a church before where the goal was to have you assimilate? Don't put up your hands, just, you know, you were supposed to believe what everyone else believed, do what everyone else did, become one of them, essentially. You ever been to that church? If you haven't been there, you probably have seen it on TV. Family Guy and The Simpsons loves to take shots at that church. Loves to take shots at that church. And we enjoy it because it's got a bit of truth to it, right? If we look at the religious right in the States, they seem to be trying to get the whole country to follow what they believe. Everybody. Same-sex marriage, education in schools, geology, paleontology. It seems about getting everyone to believe the same thing, to have the same theology. But we don't talk about that a whole lot here at Friends Church, do we? We affectionately call ourselves theological minimalists, which basically means we don't talk about certain beliefs very much. We can always tell when people have come to Friends Church, they're new here, but they've been to other churches for a long time. They'll always say to us, you guys don't reference the Bible enough, or you don't talk, like there's no meat, which is just a fancy way of saying it's kind of simple. It's not about the complex theologies that they're used to talking about. And the thing is, we know those complex theologies, you know, hypostatic union, Trinitarianism, eschatology. Well, I know all those words. I spend a lot of money learning about those things. We know how they work. We know the churches that are associated with them, but we don't really talk about those models of God. So why? In fact, most of the time we talk about, what are you guys going to do on Monday? Jeff said it. It's not about what you're going to do here sitting in the seat. It's about, what does your life look like? How are you impacting your world? So the question I want to ask today is, why, when so many other churches, past or present, seem to be preaching that you need to know more about God, you need to have more complex models of God, do we seem to ignore that altogether? Why do we do things differently? So today I want to answer that question. And in fact, I actually want to try and go a little bit further. I want to try and convince you that the Friends Church way is actually completely consistent with our church ancestors. And I want to do that by telling you a little story about a woman named Rahab. Better known on the street corner in her day as Rahab the whore. And I know that word sounds a bit harsh, but if you check the text, that's the word. That's what she is. She's not an escort. She's not a companion. She's a prostitute technically, but there's a sense of her of she's poor. She has nothing. She's fallen into this thing. This is all that she has left. And so the Bible calls her Rahab the whore. And the Bible starts with telling the story of, you know, Moses and the Ten Commandments and getting people out of Egypt and all that kind of stuff. Well, after he died, Moses died, a guy named Joshua took over. And God and Joshua got together and they had a mandate, at least this is how it reads in the story, that Joshua needed to conquer the city of Jericho, which is a problem because Rahab the whore lived in Jericho. So you kind of imagine her, dirt poor, nothing. She's trying to take care of her whole family. They don't have enough money. There's no, in their culture, males in the family to take care of the money part, so she's doing it. She's beaten down, kind of shut down. Just life hasn't been easy for Rahab. And the narrative describes her living in a two-story house right on the edge of town. In fact, her window, her upper story window, was in the wall of the city. Because Jericho was known for having a massive wall. This place was robust. And this is how it worked. Men would come to her front door. Her parents would go into the back room. She would talk about compensation and all that stuff. And the rest would follow. And that was the life of Rahab. Then one day, she heard a knock on the door. And you ever have those feelings where something's not quite right? She had one of those feelings where it's like, something's off here. But for Rahab and her family, a knock on the door meant food on the table. So she's got to do what she's got to do, right? So she opens the door to see two men. And right away, they feel off. Something about these men just... And it's not uncommon in her line of work to meet new people, of course. We understand that. But there's something about these men that made her look twice. It's like they didn't come from Jericho. They weren't locals. Now, just that morning, Rahab's dad had come back from the market with news of the invading army that was crossing the desert, coming towards Jericho. It was led by Joshua, who we just met. And these guys were just, like, on a mission. And they were heading straight to Jericho. Like, everything. It was just, like, straight to Jericho. Anything in their way, they just blew it down. Boom, straight to Jericho. Each day, there was people staggering in, you know, survivors from other towns going, I don't know what happened. These guys just came in and, like, they are on a mission here. But really, Jericho was surrounded by a massive wall, right? They were safe, right? They would protect them, right? But what if it didn't? You'd see often people going to visit their relatives, also known as running scared out of the city, but they're not, they don't want to tell everyone that they're scared, so they pretend to go on a vacation just that this happens to be at this time. Just so you know, that passes for humor in Vince Land. There we go. That was a very funny joke. Thank you. Makes me feel much better about myself. If you knew all the stuff I knew about Jericho culture, you'd know that that's hilarious, you know? Driving out with their wagon, their bed on the back, people saying, why do you have your bed on the back? Well, I don't like my relative's bed, so I'd like to take my own bed when I go, you know, that kind of thing. But the problem with Rahab and her family is they're dirt poor. They got nowhere to go. They are stuck here. So it's in the face of this and looking at these two men at her door that she realizes they aren't from around here, that something bigger was about to happen. The usual discussion's completed, money changed hands, she takes them upstairs to her bedroom, and it was only after they started removing their clothes that she realized they are not from around here. These guys are not from Jericho. In fact, these guys are Joshua's men. These are the men that are part of the army marching on Jericho right now. These are the guys rolling through the countryside just like eyes set on Jericho going, we will take you down. Wouldn't it be crazy to realize you're actually sleeping with the enemy? But Rahab doesn't feel quite what she expects. Sure, there's fear. She's in a city that's, you know, there's a large army marching on her city. That's going to cause some fear. But that's not it. And there's the fear for her own life and the fear for her family, but she's a woman who's been taking care of her family for years. She knows that fear. That fear has been inside of her for years. It's something else. Something not really physical, and it hits her. Something's going on here. Her father said that the reason this army was winning every battle that they fought on the way to Jericho was because, and this is the words he used, God was in control. You see, in their culture, God controlled everything. Everything. Weather, you name it. That's how the story's written. And in their worldview, God wanted Joshua to take over Jericho. And so that's what's going to happen. The reason they won all their battles is because their God is stronger than the other gods. That's how the story plays out. And Rahab just knew, like she knew many things in her life, that their God was stronger than the Jericho God. And so it was only a matter of time. Days, maybe weeks. And Jericho is just going to be another burned out city in the wake of that army. And the interesting thing, the men in her bedroom didn't represent a larger fighting force. It's not that they were stronger, although it was a solid army. And it wasn't really that they were part of the plot to take over the city, although, they were spies. But the men represented the power between their God and her God. And she believed that their God was going to win. So the only thing that was left was, how are we going to survive this sucker? How are the poor people like Rahab and her family and all the other people who didn't have relatives outside of the city, how are they going to survive? So Rahab couldn't sleep that night. The men went down, or she went downstairs and the men readied themselves for bed. And this is when she hears a knock on the door. And this is where the story gets a little bit bizarre. Because it's the police, or their kind of version of the police. So like the king of Jericho sends the police to her house. And they're like, excuse me, ma'am. You had two guests here this evening. Your neighbors told us. We'd like to know where the guests are. And you'd think that she would just kind of go like, check up in my bedroom. Sorry, like my bad, didn't know who they were, take them out. But she does something really, really weird here. She does what we all do when the cop pulls us over when we've been speeding and asks us, do you know how fast you were going? And what do we all say? Sorry, I don't know. We knew we were going 130 in the 50 zone, but you know, we all play dumb. So she plays dumb. She's like, two guys? Oh, yeah, I met with two guys, you know. But they left hours ago. You know, probably couldn't afford the night, so out the door. I figured they were new in town, didn't really know what was going on, so whatever. They left hours ago. They went out the main gate. You probably could catch them if you ran, but yeah, they're gone. It wasn't even a good performance. Like, never mind great. It was like half performance. And she's paid for her performance, so she knows a bad performance when she sees one. This is a bad performance. And what do the police do? Sounds good, ma'am. Have a nice day. They go running out the gate and go after the guys that she told them were out the front gate. And you can just see Rahab going, okay, how exactly did that go down? Something more is happening here. Something bigger. And that's when she kind of hatches a plan. She comes up with this idea. She puts on her robe and she goes upstairs to the guys. She has this conversation with them. And this is the interesting thing is the reader, as we read this, it's interesting because Rahab the whore told the spies that said, look, I just saved your butt. And in fact, I'm going to do even more for you guys. If and only if, when you guys come through Jericho, you save me and my family. She told them that she knew their God was stronger than the Jericho God, and so Jericho was done. But then she did something really, really, really simple. Something that seemed obvious. Rahab, but the thing is, the thing that's so obvious, this is why we talk about Rahab the whore from the Bible. She became a hero of the Christian life. And it wasn't her higher knowledge of God. It wasn't her understanding of abstract theology and all that kind of stuff. It wasn't even her faith. What made Rahab the whore a major player in the biblical story was she tied a rope out of her back window. Because remember, she was right on the wall. And she let them climb out that rope and get out of the city. She saved their lives. She did something. She acted. The biblical story tells it like she was an agent of God. She was part of God's story and making it happen. She was actively supporting God's plan in this world. So it was for her actions, not her faith, that Rahab the whore is often named alongside Abraham, the father of the Jewish people. She's named in Jesus' genealogy alongside King David and King Solomon. Like, we're talking, this is top shelf here. And she's named in this little book right at the end of the New Testament. A little book that's caused a lot of controversy from the church fathers. You know, Martin Luther, he hated this book. In fact, he said we should just tear out the Bible and not use it altogether. His followers, he was all like, okay, use every book but this book. This one sucks. Get rid of it. Because in that book, again, we find Rahab the whore. Thousands of years later, Rahab the whore is held up as the paragon of what it means to be a Christian. What it means to follow God. What it means to be righteous. This is our model because of our actions. The storyteller Eugene Peterson wrote it this way in his adaptation of the Bible called The Message. He says, wasn't the actions of Rahab, the whore from Jericho, in hiding God's spies and helping them escape, that seamless unity of believing and doing what counted with God? I love that line. The seamless unity of believing and doing. Not just believing, but doing. Not just theology, but actions. Not just the right model of God. We've talked about that for years, but no, making God's plan in this world happen. Eugene Peterson goes on in the next line and says this, the very moment you separate body and spirit, you end up with a corpse. Separate faith and works, you get the same thing, a corpse. Knowing God without doing things, it's a dead thing. I'm not saying here acting like you believe. This isn't a proof of your belief. That's not what I'm getting at. You notice from the story of Rahab, it's not her belief that God would beat her God and all that stuff. It was that she helped God's plan come to fruition. That's why the story's there, I think. She helps the spies escape. For lack of a better term, she makes God's plan happen in the world. And that's why we here at Friends Church talk the way we do. We speak more about what's going on Sunday, or going on Monday, than we do about what you know. We speak more about a way of living, a way of being in this world. The word Christian means to be Christ-like, to live like Christ. That's what we're about. We call this action orientation. To make sure we never forget this, we have a story that we tell. We've told it over the last 6 years. And it's a story that shaped Friends Church, shaped us from the beginning, and continues to shape us. It's our way of trying to make sure that our spiritual lives will not become that corpse that Eugene Peterson talks about. For those of you who are new, just listen. Just listen and feel what it brings up inside of you. But for those of you who, like me, have been here for the last 6 years, this is our founding story. This is what we're about. This is the story that says Friends Church exists because of this. So I want you to remember this story. Think about it now and again. We call it the castle and the well. And the story tells of a land with a well on it. And the well had wonderful, cool water. And of course, the land around it prospered. We're talking green fields, happy animals, people happy, healthy, living long lives. Society was prospering because of this well. But the landowner had to leave. And so he left the well in the care of the people around him. And for the first little while, it was all good. The prosperity continued. Everything was good. But soon people started to get scared. Like, how much water's in that well anyways? What happens if we run out? Like, what happens What happens to my kids or to me if there's not enough water? Everything comes from that well, doesn't it? So they started to build rules around who could access the well, trying to make sure that they wouldn't run out of water. Strangers? Well, that's obvious. They can't have any water because they're strangers. We don't like them anyways. Get rid of them. And people we don't like, yeah, for sure, those people don't get it. People who are part of our community but are a little bit, you know, off a little bit, just a little different, we're definitely not going to let them have the water. People who don't support this whole questioning period, yeah, they're gone too. And over the years, more and more rules got written down. And pretty soon the rules became walls. And there's a fence grew up around this well, making sure that the people who were supposed to get the water got the water and nobody else. And over the years, the access to that water was extremely limited. And the water, or the world outside that well, outside that wall, changed drastically. Remember, it was green and beautiful. Now it's a desert. Famine. Drought. Think like the worst war zone you can explain. People like dying from lack of water. And the water's just feet away. The landowner found out what was going on, and he sent his son back to check it out. And the son saw what was happening. He was like, "What are you people? What are you people thinking?" He goes to the well and bangs on the gate. And after a bunch of rigmarole, they let him in. And he's like, "This is not what my father intended. This is not what this well is for." And you guys know it, and I know it. But they wouldn't listen. Or at least most of them wouldn't listen. But a few of them remembered what the world looked like before the walls. Remember what the world looked like when the water was for everybody. And he started to get a group of people together. And they gained steam, and they gained momentum, and they ended up taking down the walls and letting people have water. But the people were so thirsty and so weak that they had to get buckets of water and take them from the well and bring them to people. Can you imagine that? You're so thirsty, your mouth is so dry, you can't even swallow anymore. And that first bit of water running down your throat, it's amazing. The people got as much as they could drink. The son and his buddies just kept bringing more and more water to everybody, saying this water is meant for you. And over time, the land changed. What was once desert became fields again. What was once a drought became a land that was rich and provided for the people. And the people, man, they prospered again. As far as you could see from this well, everything changed. The land was amazing. The people's lives changed. And then the people in charge, one day asked a question and said, "I wonder how much water there's in that well." They ended up building a castle around that well, making sure that nobody who they didn't want would have access to that water. And to do it, they had to kill the son, so they did. They murdered the son and stopped the movement. Over the last 2,000 years, the church, or at least parts of the church, have been amazing at building walls around water to control who gets access, who can be a part of this thing, how the water goes out. But we here at Friend Church use this story to remind ourselves that that's not what we're about. We will not use our beliefs, our theologies, our liturgies, our church culture, whatever. We will not use any of that stuff to create walls to keep people out of the way from the water. We will be a church that brings water to the world around us. We will be a church of action. We will be a church that does good things in this world. We'll be a church that acts like Jesus acted. We will be a church based on the story of Rahab the whore. We will be a church that brings water to the world around us. Now let me say, usually at this point in the discussion, somebody will say to me, but Vince, but what about beliefs? I'm not saying they're bad. Beliefs often lead to action. But when beliefs get in the way of living, get in the way of actions, get in the way of living this way, we're not super cool with them. That's why I told you the story of Rahab the whore. Because she would have been outside the castle walls. She would have been the person dying of thirst. She was a whore after all, right? According to the church? Yeah. Yet our spiritual ancestors ask us to see her as the paragon or the model of what it means to be a Christian, to live out this Christian life. Because she acted. It wasn't about her beliefs, it was about her actions. Did her faith impact her actions? I'm sure they did. I can't help but think that they did. But that's not what the story is about. The story is about how she acted. So like Rahab the whore, we want each and every one of you to live this thing out. To live like Christ in your world. To let your beliefs come out in your hands, in your feet, and in your money, and in your mouth, and you name it, everything. We don't want our faith to be a dead thing. I've been to a lot of churches in my life, and I've been to a lot of them that seemed like a graveyard. That's not who we want to be. The world around us is hurting. They're dying of thirst, and we have the water. And that's why we wrote ourselves this value, to make sure that we would keep this in our minds. We said, we value action-oriented Christianity. We believe that our spiritual ancestors saw their faith as more of a way of life than just an internally held set of beliefs. We believe the effect of living out our faith as followers of Christ will repair our world, restoring it to the picture God intended. When you hear us talking about taking water, that's what we're talking about. An action-oriented Christianity. And we define water as anything in and through you that God can use to make this world a better place. Anything. Everything. What we can do for people in our world who have less. The physical water that we have. The lunches that we make for kids. It blows me away that in Calgary, such an affluent city, there's thousands of kids who go to school every day without a lunch because their parents can't afford it. When you're a 10-year-old boy, school's enough of an issue to pay attention to. If you're starving, if you can't even pay attention because you're so hungry, how do you get ahead? This isn't just in kids, this is in adults. I'm talking like they don't have good food, like Sunterra food. I'm talking they don't have any food. Take it wider than that. Look outside of Calgary. Look at Canada. Look at the world. Rio Azul, Mexico. There is so much physical water out there that we can take. It blows my mind. And yet we have physical water to give. We can make the world better physically, can't we? Whether it's our time, our resources, we have that water. We also have what I like to call relational water. There's people in our world who nobody cares for them. No one loves them. They're all alone. No one to talk to. No one to share their lives with. They're relationally thirsty. And we can call a friend who's lonely. Visit the person going through a hard time. Give a hug to a person in need. We can give relational water. There's so much we have to give. And think about the difference it makes in the lives of the people around you. That simple phone call, or that even that text saying, hey, how's it going? Thinking about you. That can change someone's life. I think another water that we have is spiritual water. And don't think proselytizing. That's not what I'm getting at here. I'm not trying to make people have certain beliefs. What I'm getting at is people craving spiritual interaction, craving it. We were out for lunch. I was out for lunch with my aunt and her partner yesterday, and we just started talking about spirituality. It was this amazing, rich conversation. We ended up both all saying, like, why don't we do this more often? This is amazing. And we can do that with the people in our lives, can't we? Cost a bottle of wine or a, you know, glass of beer and say, come on over, let's chat. Let people talk about what's going on inside of them spiritually. What's going on? How does it work for them? Invite them here, something to connect with God or be inspired or to be challenged. I don't know. But I think we have spiritual water to give. And I could go on for hours and hours and talk to you about all the different water I think there's out there. But what we found is something interesting. You guys are awesome. When we say, hey, go and do this, you guys go and do this. But when we tell you what to do and we're too specific about it, you do what we tell you to do. And then you only do what we tell you to do. You don't do anything else. So today I don't want to get too prescriptive. I don't want to say, like, here's what I want you to do. I want this to be a wider thing. I want this to be something that's an expression of who you are, of your unique situation, of your talents, of your world, the people in your lives, the opportunities that you have, the passions that you have, your connection with God. This is the more than that I talk about often when I talk about God, a God that can guide us to things that we could never come up with on our own, impact that we could never have outside of that. Engage this idea of God in your lives. Let God guide you to something that is profound in this world. So in order to do this, in order to inspire you but not get too prescriptive, we came up with something last year. We called it 31 and 31. And it was a blast. I don't know how many times it made me sweat, but it was amazing. I was in lineup at Costco because Costco hot dogs are awesome. And I had this thing that the whole time I would buy whoever's behind me whatever meal that they had. And so I'm, you know, pulling my wallet out, and lo and behold, I look behind me, and there's a beautiful younger girl behind me. And I'm thinking, how exactly am I going to offer to buy her lunch without being a creepy old guy? But it was awesome. She actually came to me after, she said, you made my day. And I bought her a dollar hot dog. It's doing something every day, all the time, being intentional. Little things. And look at your lives. You guys know what this looks like. Giving somebody a call, giving someone a hug, donating money to a cause you believe in, volunteering for something, I don't know, baking cookies for someone down the block, whatever it is. It's not that it has to be the major thing. It's that you do something and you let God guide that part of your life. Because what's amazing is this group of people doing this for 31 days, I think that's going to change our world. That's 6,000 acts of making the world a better place. That's amazing. So here's what I want you to do. I want you guys to commit to looking at your spirituality through this action-oriented lens. Not about beliefs, not about complexities of theology, not about fancy words, not about education. It's not about that. Look at it through this lens of action, of making the world a better place, of living like Christ in your world. So why do we care more about what you do on Monday than what you're doing today? It's because of the story of Rahab the whore. It's because of the story of the castle and the well. And this metaphor of taking water to your world. It's because of what Eugene Peterson so beautifully said. Christianity without actions is a dead corpse. I don't want that for any of us today. So, I want you to go from here today. Take the 31 and 31 challenge. The First Impressions team has little pieces of paper. You can write down what you're doing every day, because I find sometimes if I can write it down, I remember it better. It makes me more intentional. If I miss a day, I'm like, oh, I missed that day. I'll get it the next day. And let's go out from here, and let's actually make a difference in our world. Let's make this world better, can we? That's all for me. I'm going to pass over to Grant. Thanks, everyone.